This is, we're continuing the interview with Douglas Furstenow in Berkeley, California on July 26, 2001 in Evans Hall. This is tape 6. Wanted to pick up on a couple of things that I learned in some reading yesterday. We were talking about Merrill and Dorr working early in the century in the Black Hills, and I came across the name Elmore as a person who was doing flotation research in her development in 1905 in Australia, and I remembered that there was a Spearfish Canyon Railway that operated in Spearfish Canyon in the Black Hills, long since defunct, but was probably operating around 1900 to 1910, and one of the stops on that railway was named Elmore, and it's still a little community there of summer cabins. People have their summer cabins at Elmore in Spearfish Canyon, and the Elmore brothers were credited with early development of bulk oil flotation in England in they were from England, and in 1898 they developed something called bulk oil flotation, and in 1904 they patented the introduction of bubbles. They had a company, I guess, called Elmore and Minerals. No, the company was called Mineral Separation that they worked for. And they built the first commercial flotation mill in 1905 in Broken Hill, Australia. So that probably is why that little stop in Spearfish Canyon was named Elmore.
That's my guess. You're probably right. The Elmore process, which was using large quantities of oil, which would wet the sulfide minerals, was the initial, really the kind of the predecessor to flotation. Mm-hmm. And they either worked with or without blowing in air bubbles, but by from what I recall from reading, strong agitation would create foam in the oil, and this foam would rise to the surface, that way they could remove the sulfide minerals. The attribute of it was it consumed a large amount of oil, but was really the predecessor of what became froth flotation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I have read that a group of senior students at Berkeley virtually, they wrote a paper which, now I'll look up where it was, that virtually was the initial, they wrote their paper on a senior research project on the Elmore process, and virtually on the verge of stating or coming on to the fact that if you added air bubbles, you would enter into true froth flotation. I'll look up that reference, because I found that very fascinating, I put it in a paper for the symposium on behalf of my brother's 65th birthday. They had a flotation symposium. I'll look that up and put it into the...
Okay, good.
Most interesting.
Uh-huh. And then the other thing that I thought we should do, give more than passing mention to, you had said that you visited the morning mine when you were at Butte, and I didn't pick up on the fact that the morning mine was one of the first places in North America where flotation was used.
Yeah, on one visiting the mill there, which was a lead zinc mill, all of the equipment, this was in summer 1950, that my friend Frank Kaplan and I were there, and all of the equipment was really ancient, and a lot of it was self-manufactured, I think. The flotation machines were sort of like old washing machines, had kind of a rotor that slopped the pulp or slurry, and when the raised it up into the air a few inches, and when it fell back down onto the surface, it created bubbles. Mm-hmm. This was their flotation machine, and another attribute of that ore, very very, they had to grind very fine, something like maybe 75% of the ore was minus 15 microns to liberate it. So there, as I remember, the grades of their products, when speaking of the lead concentrate and zinc concentrate, were never very high because of that. Interesting old mill, big one, and a major one in its day.
Mm-hmm. Was that one of the first times? Well, no, that wasn't your first contact with an old flotation.
Oh, No. That's just part of the large number that we visited in the Coeur d'Alene lead zinc district of Idaho, which, you know, was really one of the major lead zinc silver districts of the United States for decades.
So now I guess we're ready to take you to Chelan.
Yeah, but before we get there, I had one, all of a sudden remembered what I was trying to come up with yesterday. My friend Don Sinus was a direct assistant to the president. It was Texas Gulf Sulfur Company.
Oh, yes.
TGS. And
give me the spelling of Sinus again.
Don Sinus.
How is it spelled?
C-E-N-I-S.
C-E-N-I-S.
And the president was Charles Fogarty, who apparently is a very able person.
Sulfur, I think, is still spelled
F-O-G-A-R-T-Y.
Right.
And he and a couple of vice presidents were killed on a private jet landing in the fog, returning home to Connecticut. I remember reading that in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, obviously a huge loss. One thing might be interesting, just to comment a little bit about Texas Gulf Sulfur. You know, they discovered that huge Timmins deposit in Ontario, which was, I think, one of the biggest zinc deposits ever found. And the chief geologist and another geologist, maybe their exploration people, went out and bought stock before they announced it, and that made the national press overdoing that, and of course they had to sell back their stock and everything else, because once that big deposit was announced, TGS stock soared.
Yeah.
But that is the kind of thing, needless to say, the exploration people, mining companies, cannot do. And generally do not do.
In the old days they did.
That's all they did.
Hoover and in his day, that was the way they operated. That was, I think, accepted, wasn't it?
Probably.
I think the exploration people always got a piece of the action in those days.
Right.
But
right.
It's frowned on now.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
It's illegal, I guess.
You can pursue personal interests elsewhere now.
Mm-hmm. Right. Uh-huh. Okay, so Texas Gulf Sulfur was the one we were trying
right,
to think
right.
of. Yeah. All right. So are you ready to go to Chelan?
Okay, yeah, that was, again, my last summer job, which for the House Sound Company had a
Excuse me, just...
Zinc, copper, and gold deposit in the Cascade Mountains. Little town there, which is the only reason the town was there was because of the mine was Holden, H-O-L-D-E-N, Holden, Washington. And one went about 45 miles up the Lake Chelan by boat to the dock there. And then, as I remember, it was maybe 10 miles up U Valley to the mine. And this was all, it was beautiful country and all glaciated, and wherever you looked there were hanging U valleys.
Mm-hmm.
Lake Chelan was a glacial valley, then the main valley going into Lake Chelan was a U valley, and there were these hanging U valleys coming in at the side of all of the of this main valley. So the place really looked like a resort, and I think today it is, because they had, the dormitories were very good, and the facilities, recreational facilities they had for the workers was excellent, and I think all of this has been converted to some kind of resort. But anyway, I worked in the mill, and just as a laborer,
Do you remember what you were paid?
No, again, I don't. But I it's funny. I recollect those childhood days. obviously, whatever the going rate would have been,
And board and room included.
There was board and room there, and whether that may have been nominal in price, but in mining camps you always eat well.
They have to do that.
And these dormitories were very nice, and I remember there was a stream flowing right behind, so if you're working in the night shift and I could hear the stream a lot of times when I was trying to sleep during the daytime.
Mm.
Anyway, the first job they gave me was picking sticks off the conveyor belt.
Oh.
And up on the crusher, because it was an underground mine, maybe 500 tons per day or something. And I remember there was 385 steps you had to climb from the bottom of the mill up to the crushers.
Ooh.
And for the first week, I could hardly do it.
Mm-hmm.
I counted them.
Oh.
And
makes my legs ache to think of it.
Well, a few years ago, we were up in Vancouver, and Howe Sound Company had a mine called Britannia Beach. Have you ever
heard of it?
Yeah, okay. Well, the old mill is still there, and we went inside of it, and it's built again up the side of the mountain, and I looked in there, and you could see about 400 steps going on up along the side. My guess is they used the same plans from Britannia Beach to the mill at Holden. Anyway,
I think Pete Fowler worked at Britannia Beach. I believe he's the one who talked.
In fact,
about
I know.
Yes.
I think I know he did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Britannia Beach was a famous Howe Sound.
Mm-hmm.
The company is called Howe Sound. I think Britannia Beach is on Howe Sound up there. I think that inlet is called Howe Sound. That's where the name of the company came from. And the object was to pick off the conveyor belt the chunks of wood that came out of the mine. And I didn't do that too long, but for a while. And they strap you in.
Oh.
I mean, you've got it strapped, so in case you don't fall in the...
Oh.
on the belt and then down into the crushers. But what happens is after a while, the belt stands still and the building moves to one sensation. I'll tell you that.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's why it's nice
spooky
to be belted in.
Oh. Because you're watching it all.
Yeah,
while.
Yeah. All of a sudden the belt stops and the place moves.
Mm.
So anyway, after, I did that for, I suppose, 3 weeks or something, something like that. And a lot of intellect required for picking the sticks.
Real entry-level job.
Oh, yeah. Mm. And then another one is, I did various little, they weren't little, regular jobs in the mill. One of them was they were taking the old tailings and with a hydraulic giant were repulping, reslurrying them, and then this was pumped to a thickener tank, and then where the fines were removed by, you know, upward flow of water, and then the sands were taken back down in the mine as mine fill. You know, the homestead, they use the sand for mine fill. And, but I recall one day I was I'd have to go down and move this hydraulic giant that was hosing down the old tailings, and I stayed down there a little too long, and by the time I got back up, the thickener was completely full of sand. The mill superintendent was a little unhappy about it, but everything had to get shut down and hosed out and started over. It's not major, but a bit of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on in the summer.
Good learning experience.
Oh, yeah, right on. Then later in the summer, I think I they put me running the zinc flotation, or it was both zinc and copper flotation cells, and I'll tell you, and this is before any automation, and you know, when you have to control levels, grades, and so on, I can see takes an operator with real experience, and one would take samples, and you'd get the analysis back 2 hours later in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see what you're always way behind on making sure the grade is there. And today, of course, this is most operations. Sampling's automatic, and the analysis done by X-ray fluorescence, and the answer comes very quickly. But then it was 2 hours. I think, if I remember, I even spent some time in the laboratory just running these analyses myself, which were all in those days chemical analysis. Nothing about that mill, excuse me. They had all, again, self-built flotation machines, and these were big troughs, which were called Monroe Pierce cells, Monroe, M-U-N-R-O-E, hyphen Pierce, P-E-A-R-S-E, I think. I'll check to see. But these were just long tanks, about 10 feet deep, and maybe 4 feet wide, and maybe 30, 40 feet long, in which they had just pipes sticking down in the bottom, blowing the air in. And these very deep cells, certain components of them had claimed advantages such as higher grade concentrates and so on, but obviously very simple machine, not even a machine. But that was, I think from reading, was the type of flotation machine they had at Britannia Beach, and they also had had there at Holden. They also had a, this was, maybe I can find out what the grades were, but it was not a high grade mine, maybe running 2-3% zinc and maybe 0.8 copper, it runs in my mind, and maybe a tenth of an ounce of gold per ton. So they then cyanided the tailings to recover the gold. Or actually, I think they floated the pyrite and then cyanided the pyrite, which had the gold in it, and the small gold plant at the tail end of it. But the area was, on weekends that I might have had off. In fact, I think the plant probably, operation may have run 6 days a week. I think it was small enough that they could shut down. I may be wrong, but I vaguely remember, you know, having most Sundays free. And to go hiking, because you could hike up to a few, 3-4 miles away. You were cirque lakes from glaciers, and these lakes really had colloidal particles that were, you know, from how the glacier did the grinding. And so I did a lot of hiking with one or two of the other, probably younger summer employees, whose names I simply don't recall. But it was a beautiful, beautiful area. And
did they have the same plan of hiring a lot of college kids in the summer to replace?
There were quite a few, and I don't, you know, this was not as big an operation as Bunker Hill. No. Bunker Hill was big, you know, mine mill, lead smelter, zinc plant. But maybe they had a handful. Because again, I'm assuming maybe some of the employees, you know, go out and lumber in the summer and so on.
Sure.
They, they could, or farm if they had a farm down below. Also, of course, in the middle of the summer, all of a sudden the paper headlines had 3-inch headlines in the Seattle paper about Korea invaded. This was summer of 1950, and that, of course, made me
nervous.
A little nervous about things. It was just a good summer, and then I, as I said, I had been planning on going to MIT, and I remember a laborer in the plant, a fairly young guy, I said I was going to MIT, and he said, oh, well, that's, well, yeah, they're the ones who just won the Henley Regatta. It made me chuckle that here this laborer knew all about the sports and about Henley Regatta, and I don't know if I'd ever even heard of the Henley Regatta, but he knew MIT had won this that year, that spring, or that summer. Interesting.
I wanted to ask, was anything done about health care at places like this?
Well, yeah, there was, I had to take a physical to start with, and they had a fairly young permanent doctor there, and obviously good medical facilities, because I you'd have to take care of if there were injuries, which I knew none of any, but being an underground mine, they must have, they have had some. But this, I remember visiting this doctor a couple times, one of them just for something, and sort of chatted with him for quite a while, which I assume he wasn't overly busy. But they They had to have that. But by the way, there was always a problem. Was that being up in the mountains and long power line distribution, that often if there was a major thunderstorm, they lost the power.
Mm-hmm.
And that did happen 2, 3, 4 times that summer. And that now means in the mill that everything shuts down, and we're talking about ball mills and the flotation machines, having thickeners all start sanding up.
Mm-hmm.
This being a major problem, and I suppose underground they would have had auxiliary power, you know, they'd have to do that to handle the underground, but they wouldn't be doing that for the mill. But they obviously had procedures to get the mill started, which now tells me that I now remember they did operate, say, 6 days a week, shut down, and it took them about a half hour to start the whole plant up again.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't a 7 day system. The mill may have run 6 days and the mine 5 days, if I, I recall. But this power loss was something they had to live with. And basically, they said that every time there was a thunderstorm, it would knock out the power on the grid somewhere. So at the end of the summer, I know there was 2, 3, 4 other of us that were leaving, and you could fly out on a flying boat, you know, that would take off, and so small one, and so 4 or 5 of us flew in this boat down, or in the airplane down to the city, or I suppose town or city of Chelan, and then drove over to Seattle, where I spent the weekend with this friend of mine, Sarah Dickerman, who had come from Seattle. My first trip to Seattle, and this would be late August, and it was all drizzle.
Uh-oh.
You know, just that light drizzle rain that the Northwest was famous for. I'd never, having lived in arid areas, I'd never seen that before.
Yeah.
Just faint, light drizzle, steadily. Then took the train all the way back Milwaukee Road through Butte and on to Miles City. And then somebody met me there and drove down to Rapid. Spent a few days there, of course, and then started the new venture, which was to go to MIT. Which
now you had not visited there, or
I'd never
seen
been east of
there.
Chicago.
Uh-huh.
In fact, Chicago was the only time east of South Dakota, as a matter of fact. I flew, in a little small plane that was, I think, smaller than a DC-3 out of Rapid City to Minneapolis, and stayed for a couple of days with some friends, and then flew to New York. And those are the days of DC-4s, and they flew low, and I remember it's like flying through canyons when you get into the clouds. Mm-hmm. As, you know, over New York State, the plane sort of went in, well, just like big canyons, because it couldn't go high, very spectacular. And I spent a few days with an aunt that lived in New York. Actually, they were living near Philadelphia at the time, but this was my mother's younger sister who lived in New York for many years, and so I had a great introduction to New York City.
Yeah.
And in the general area for a few days, and of course that's a great change from having spent a summer in Olden, Washington.
Oh yeah. Uh-huh.
Then went took the train, which is what you, as you know, is about 4 hours or something up New York to Boston, and then what did you take, the MTA over to Central Square in Cambridge, and found my way to the MIT grad house where I lived for 3 years as a graduate student, and that was my first indoctrination to Cambridge.
Pretty and, exciting.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. It's it then of course I suppose went over to the, you know, MIT in those days was basically one big building. You know, there's a dome in the center, and it goes with sort of arms sticking out, the metallurgy department was, I still recall, it was building 8 off to the far end, long walk down the hall, and of course met then Professor Godin and Professor Spedden, who was there for a couple of years yet, and Phil DeBrain, D-E, with a little D, and then capital B-R-U-Y-N, was a assistant professor. Spedden was assistant professor, and DeBrain was still working on his thesis, so he was an assistant professor and grad student at the same time. And of course this was just about the time the term started, so you know, one discussed what kind of courses one would take and so on, and met the various students in the group, which, you know, may have been at least 10 or a dozen graduate students.
Did you know any of the other students?
Not before.
No.
Not before. They were a variety of them, and you know, several Americans.
Now, you were just beginning to say that there were several Americans among
them. Oh, yeah. Okay, I'll... you asked the question about the student.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had not known any of the other students before?
None at all, and they were a wide range of students. From all over, maybe I'll mention some of them as we go along. In the grad house where I lived, my roommates were all fellow students for the very first term, really the first. Most of the first year, the suites were that there were two rooms, one on with a bathroom in between, and then there were two single beds and desks in each room. It was quite a nice setup, huge old building that must date back to several decades. Right in the corner of Mass Ave and Memorial Drive, I think it's called. And one roommate was from Pennsylvania, and his particular roommate was somebody named Peter Laxson from South Africa, and Peter Laxon returned to South Africa and became one of the real giants of carbon and pulp process. Now the first carbon and pulp process was put in up there at Homestead, but he did research for what was called, at least now called Mintec in South Africa, and that was his whole career, and I think he sort of became Mr. Carbon and Pulp through his career. And by the way, this Peter Laxon liked to play rugby, there was another South African who was doing a doctorate in mechanical engineering, and his name I don't remember, but I'll find out. But I remember meeting him and going out to dinner a lot. We ate dinner a lot together. And later, this person, who also returned to South Africa, won all sorts of gold medals and so on. He was the inventor of the process of pumping slurried ice down in the deep mines to cool them.
Hmm.
You know, if you pump cold air 10,000 feet down, the compression is such that the air will be just as hot as a rock, so you can't cool. So he came up with the idea of pumping ice water slurries down to cool the mines. And I'd read all about this and didn't realize that this was the person,
well,
the person that I used to one time know, until I saw a picture of him once.
Uh-huh.
His ears took straight out. It was the very same person. But that was a for South Africa, with those deep mines, he did a major impact. And I'll get his name. Then my roommate was for part of the first term, was somebody who was a French Canadian from Quebec, Pierre G. Guy Powell. Guy Powell. And there was a Frenchman in our group who came when I did, named Jean Tournesac. And one time Tournesac told me that when he would speak in French to Guy Powell, who had come from studying Laval, Powell would answer him in English. Now this, remember, 1950. And Tournesac said, you know, they're ashamed of their French in Quebec, so he wouldn't speak French back to him. Now, that's obviously not the way it is in Quebec anymore.
No.
But I find that very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, there were two people just finishing up. One named Mel Chang was just writing his doctor's thesis just as I was arriving, and so for a few months I had interaction with him. He's kind of a live wire. Who at one time I know he lived out here in Orinda, and then I think he moved to Charlotte, North Carolina. I haven't crossed paths for years. But the other one was a person who was there, had been there 3 years, and they were flunking him out. And I'll tell you, when you just arrive and you learn that somebody, they've said, well, after 3 years, we'll give you a master's degree, but you're going to leave. And I still remember Professor Godin being very distressed at the head of the metallurgy department, Missouri School of Mines, who had been an undergrad at Montana School of Mines when Gaudin was there, so Gaudin knew him well, and this person had written, I gave a good reference to this person that was being flunked out, and I still recall Gaudin saying that he really held it against the professor for not being honest about saying what the shortcomings of this person mm-hmm. was. So I've sort of always kept that in mind, that you don't whitewash or say things that the person can't live up to. No. That can come back to haunt you. First day, I guess you're worried they might sue you. Huh?
Don't raise the expectations too much.
Uh-huh. Hey, isn't that right? Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah. that makes a new student a little nervous that all
yes.
of a sudden one of them is, obviously, you know, he'd taken his main orals and probably just flunked them cold and that's part of the trauma of the mm-hmm. doctor's program everywhere, I think. And
that's what makes the PhD valuable.
true. Mm-hmm. At least I think. G. Powell, I remember, he then decided to live somewhere other than in the grad house. And so in the middle of the semester, another grad student that was part of our own group moved in, and he was my roommate for about half of this first semester. His name was Olaf Malgren, an excellent person who really did a lot of fine work later on in his career. Maybe I'll touch on that again later. But Olaf, I thought, was English. And he was an Englishman. He spoke English like an Englishman. And one day, quite a while after I had gotten there, he told me he was Norwegian. Mm-hmm. And every time I've seen him, which had been about 3 times in 50 years since, he reminds me of my comment. And I said, "You're Norwegian." I said, "Well, you know where I come from? We call a Norwegian nothing but a Swede with his brains blown out."
That's
about eastern South Dakota, right? And Olaf has always reminded me of. Of course, my mother's half Norwegian, Olaf, every time I've seen him, that's the first thing he said. My comment to him, which but he'd obviously learned English from somebody who mm-hmm. whose English was an Englishman, I suppose, teaching up there, and when he was in school, which gave him the answer.
He was actually. In Norway.
Oh yeah.
He's not far from England.
Yeah, and very capable person, but anyway, we, the graduate program at MIT is in those days, and still, maybe that way. There were no requirements. For a major, you had to have one minor, which in their system of counting was 24 units. What I took my minor in was chemistry. But even though there were no requirements for the major, I either took or audited. You know, quite a few of the MIT metallurgy courses. And so the persons who had undergraduate degrees from MIT, you know, did have an advantage over those that didn't, because they'd already had, let's say, the courses. So I took some of the courses for credit and audited some through the course of my the academic part of my time there. And
was it just called metallurgy? No.
There were, the department was metallurgy, and they MIT did them by course numbers, and that was course three. You know, I think civil engineering's course one, and I know course three is metallurgy, and course five is chemistry. It may have been in the historical sequence at which they were established.
Mm-hmm.
And chemical engineering is course 10, and they can go up to 20 now, I think, like, you know, some of the more modern and things that have come along, like communications or things like that. And but the first terms, a lot of the research was using radioactive tracers, and so one course that everybody took first term was one called radiochemistry, and it was all full of physics and chemistry majors, and I remember the professor was a very famous person named Coryell, who gave open book midterm exams, and I still can remember some physics student coming in. He had about 8-10 books on each side of him. He was so busy going through the books that I don't think, it was almost laughable to be able to see him sitting there with two stacks of books, during the exam, which, to look at, and this particular exam, the only reason I'm commenting on it is one question was plot some kind of Z over A ratio versus something, and I hadn't the faintest idea, and I just drew a line across the paper, and lo and behold, I got it right.
Huh?
And believe it or not, with all those physicists and chemists there, I think I got the highest grade on that midterm.
Oh.
Now, totally out of my element or my field, but well, I studied and so on. But I will say this: we talked a little bit earlier about apprehension coming, from a small town, small school environment. I did. I quickly found that I could do just as well as. Or did do just as well as anybody, and no matter where they came from, maybe somebody who had his BS from MIT may have had the advantage, as I said, of already having had a lot of the coursework. But my background was total par with anybody else's, and so I quickly found that out, and just never had that as an apprehension. But I have seen this thing through the years here, being a professor, of people coming from small schools are happier in their nest and. and getting out of it.
Well, there's also, and I'm sure we'll mention this, the possible distraction of all those other things available around Boston that you took advantage of.
My friend, my wife still makes comments about our eating habits. My roommates and I, there was a restaurant called the Honeybee Cafe that we ate in every single night for a year. I can't believe it. Every night we'd walk up to Central Square, and eat there every single night. Probably had either a pork chop or Salisbury steak. You know, the Salisbury steak of New England, the, you know, hamburger mixed with I don't know what spices and whatnot, but that's a New England. Mm-hmm. Every night, the second year, every night to a restaurant called Simeone's and had spaghetti. Spaghetti with, I mean, I can't believe that one would get in a rut and never change it. And spaghetti with tomato sauce, spaghetti with meat sauce. And but Friday they had fried clams, and I'll tell you, I sure wish I could have those fried clams today. They were marvelous, you know. And by the way, you know, these cost only 75, 80 cents for meals in those days. And one another activity was every Saturday having lunch at Durgan Park. Mm-hmm. You surely must have been.
I remember Durgan Park a few times, yes.
And in those days you get a big meal for 95 cents. Mm-hmm. That included dessert and chowder like two big pieces of a pork loin. That's mm-hmm. what I usually had.
So there was no food service at the Grad House.
Oh, there was, but I had breakfast there, and breakfast was very light, and lunch just either ate, went over there for lunch. There would be dinner, but I guess we must have quickly decided it was better to go out.
Mm-hmm.
Ate out every single dinner. I doubt if I ever had more than one dinner at the Grad House.
Yeah.
Probably these roommates that I have been there a year, and that's probably how we got started and just carried it on. And
I guess that wasn't included in the cost then.
It must not have been. We must have paid each. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be like a dorm you lived in or dorms over at Harvard or Radcliffe. That included meals.
So probably
MIT dorms included meals, mm-hmm. but this being a graduate house was a completely different kind of...
What did you do about laundry at all these places?
Hey, believe it or not, I stupidly for the first...
Even back in
year or no, first couple of times actually used one of these laundry things and sending it home. I quit that, but you know that used to be a standard kind of college
sort
thing.
Sort of a brown cardboard thing.
50 years ago, but then
I
all of a sudden decided that was not the thing to do, and there was took care of that at a Chinese laundry down in Central Square. I remember a shirt you could get done for 15 cents kind of thing. And so I took all my laundry there, and now that you ask about it, I remember there was a fiber made by Union Carbide. I think they still use it in blankets, but I had socks. And I may say, maybe even a half a dozen pairs of this fiber, and I took them to the laundry, and when I got them back, they were like little doll socks. The heat, I suppose, in the dryer caused some kind of reaction. Dynel.
I'd forgotten Dynel.
Yeah, and see, so obviously that happened to it, so they quit using it except in things like blankets, right? I had these hard little socks about 2 inches long back, and so that was one part of it. But then
let's just divert for a second. In Butte and places like that, when you were off working in the summer, what did you do about laundry? Were there washwomen or?
Well, you know, that in Chicago, we probably could use the washing facilities of Mrs. Croker's house, mm-hmm. and and Shirley
at
both of these summer places, you know, either in Idaho or out at Lake Chelan, they may have had laundry facilities in the, because these were sort of large dormitory kind of thing.
I'm trying to think when laundromats and that kind of thing came in. And were you doing your own washing or sending it out to somebody else?
Yeah. Because, well, I took it to a laundry in Cambridge, but
you weren't running machines yourself at that point.
Yeah, I don't think laundromats like we know today existed. And well, that just draws a blank on that. I'll bet it viewed us. Was using this standard college send it home stuff.
Maybe.
You know, they had all these laundry boxes, you know, that were sort of expandable brown boxes that
heavy sort of leatherette or cardboard.
Yeah, they were cardboard but
with web straps.
Oh yeah. You know exactly. That's what,
and
so I know
it. Window for the address card, you turned it over and slipped it in and sent it home to Mama.
Yeah, send it,
she sent it back with cookies.
Yeah, you hit it right in the head. I did that maybe once or twice and then I quit that.
Isn't that funny? Nobody in the world would do that now.
No. But the laundromats didn't exist then.
No.
Because automatic.
And boys didn't do laundry.
Right.
Men, young men, never occurred to you to run a washing machine, I'm sure.
What was a good friend there at MIT was this person from Montana, Jack Jordan, who'd fallen down the mine that I told you about. Mm-hmm. He came as a junior in chemistry to MIT. So I had one or two courses even with him, one of them.
He was an undergraduate.
He was a junior, undergraduate.
I see.
Yeah. He did his first 2 years at Butte, mm-hmm. and then transferred there. And so for long, I mean, we did a lot of things together, which I will get to shortly, but he then lived in an undergraduate mm-hmm. dorm, so he would have was never part of the. Well, he was part of the Saturday meal, but not at Durgan Park, but not of the evening meals that I mentioned. But then in the winter term between let me back up. There was somebody who became very active in the AIME named Roshan Bapu. I don't know if you. He came to MIT in the fall of 1950 as a graduate student. He'd done a bachelor's degree and maybe master's at Colorado School. Maybe his bachelor's was in Pakistan. I don't know. But he did a master's at Colorado School of Mines. And he was going to go out for Christmas to see his girlfriend. He was lonely for her. And Carmen, you may have met
Carmen. I remember Carmen.
Lovely woman, who he later married. So he loaned me his car, and Jack Jordan and I drove down for Christmas to my aunt's near Philadelphia, in his old car, and one thing I remember, they're taking us to Longwood Gardens, which is lovely DuPont
mm-hmm.
garden. They live great, somewhere near there.
Yeah.
And anyway, on the way back, we had the car full of stuff. Maybe my aunt gave me a bunch of things. Like, I remember some painting she used to paint. And so this car was, the back seat was full of stuff, of anyway, we stopped to have eat dinner and some, because then it was all just two-lane highways, and somewhere we were in Massachusetts, but it was like 8 o'clock in the night, dark. And we got right, not just a short distance down the road, and the cops pulled us over and wanted to see my driver's license.
Yeah.
And I was from South Dakota, and South Dakota had no driver's license. You know, this guy couldn't, the highway patrolman couldn't believe it. There was somebody without a driver's license, but he'd seen this car full of stuff. That we weren't speeding or anything, but he just wanted to check on this car loaded with stuff. But when I didn't have a driver's license, but there were none, as you well recall, South Dakota.
You couldn't rent a car.
No, right. Well, I got a driver's license, needless to say, fairly soon thereafter. Yeah. But that a little traumatic. Anyway,
good thing you had an honest face.
I guess you're right. And of course, Jack Jordan had one from Montana, but maybe the policeman made him drive the rest of the way back to Boston. We weren't too far out of Boston, but by the way, Roshan decided after one semester to go back to Colorado. And he eventually did a doctor's degree at Colorado School of Mines and got married to Carmen, who, as I said, a very lovely lady. And Roshan, as you know, was president of SME and also president of AIME. And I think Carmen was very active in WAMES, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Extremely active, I think.
Yes.
Unfortunately, she got cancer and died some years ago. Mm-hmm. And come back to that if it turns out, I didn't know it was on his way to get married again when I met him at a meeting in Australia once. Anyway, then came a new roommate moved in. And he was my roommate for all the rest of my years there and played a major role in my life, which we'll get to eventually, named Bud Samuel, Samuel, Bud. He was doing a PhD in biophysics, and he had an undergraduate been at Case in electrical engineering, I think, and in physics and electrical engineering, something like that. And he had another friend that had come from Case named Jim Tewksbury, who I've had a lot of interaction with, because Tewksbury, after finishing his PhD, worked out here for Chevron, and we saw him many, many times when we moved here to Berkeley. But anyway, Bud Samuel and I lived together there for the next 2.5 years, and he and Jim Tewksbury and I guess were the three that did evening meal that never seemed to vary from then on. But you're talking about activities. On Memorial Day in 1951, Jack Jordan said, "Let's go to the ball game." And we went to New York. At that time, the Braves were in Boston, and of course, the Red Sox right nearby. And we went to, it was New York Giants and the Boston Braves, and it was a doubleheader that went from 1 till about 9 o'clock, and it was even drizzling then. And you know, I got hooked on baseball. You'd think one wouldn't. And so I used to, and don't think I'm stretching it, would maybe go 15 20 games a year. It was 60 cents to sit in the bleachers, and you could walk half hour to Braves Field, and maybe 20 minutes or 25 minutes to walk to Fenway Park. And you know, just in an evening or an afternoon, 60 cents go sit in the bleachers. And,
mm-hmm.
and I really, as I said, for years got really hooked on baseball. I haven't been to a baseball game for years, but I knew all the statistics. And but we're talking the days of
Boston had
Ted Williams. And, you know, that one year the team as a whole batted over 300, including pitchers. And, you know, they had Ted Williams and Dom DiMaggio and,
mm-hmm.
and
Vince DiMaggio. Is it Dom?
What?
Vince
DiMaggio. Oh, Vince DiMaggio, he played, he was the oldest and already gone, but he played for the Braves apparently in the 30s. But I really more got hooked on the National League games, and oh, I went to each of them, but even went to, when I went to visit my aunt in New York, I remember going twice to Ebbets Field to see the Dodgers and once to the Polo Grounds where the Giants played and once to Yankee Stadium.
Mm.
So you can see I really got hooked, and there was a game, it was again a Memorial Day in Boston in 52 when Mickey Mantle was a rookie and he struck out five times in a row and Casey Stengel benched him.
Oh!